This is Impeachment, a daily podcast from WNYC. I'm Brian Lehrer. It's Thursday, January 30th. Today might be the second to last day of the impeachment trial. It will depend if there are enough votes tomorrow to call new witnesses. If not, President Trump will likely be acquitted before you go out for Friday night drinks. For this segment, we'll play a few of the most interesting, outrageous, or politically important moments from the senator's Q&A session and get a take on the big picture from Ezra Klein, co-founder of Vox, who hosts his own impeachment podcast and has a new book called Why We're Polarized. Mitt Romney is the Republican considered most likely to vote for witnesses. It'll take four Republicans to get there. But here's a question submitted by Romney that seems intended to suggest that the evidence is incomplete without John Bolton.
Question from Senator Romney is for the counsel to the president. On what specific date did President Trump first order the hold on security assistance to Ukraine, and did he explain the reason at that time?
That was Chief Justice Roberts reading Romney's question. Here is Trump attorney Pat Philbin's unsatisfying response.
I don't think that there is evidence in the record of a specific date, the specific date. But there is testimony in the record that individuals at OMB and elsewhere were aware of a hold as of July 3rd. And there is evidence in the record of the president's rationales from even earlier than that time.
So Philbin admits they cannot yet answer one of the key questions. When did the president order the hold on the military aid to Ukraine? A key piece of information that could establish how much corrupt intent the president had. Bolton would likely know the answer to when Trump ordered it. The Trump defense team also had to answer for when he first expressed interest in having Ukraine investigate if Joe Biden did anything corrupt. That's a key piece of evidence, because if it was only as Biden became a serious presidential candidate, it would prove Trump had no ongoing interest in fighting corruption by Burisma or in Ukraine. He only had a personal one. Bolton, as national security advisor, might also know that. Score some points for the pro-witnesses side. But here's another clip. In fact, it was the first question submitted yesterday jointly by three Republicans whose votes for witnesses could be crucial. To my ear, this question looks like they're fishing for an excuse to acquit the president, even if he corruptly blackmailed Ukraine. Recognize this voice?
I send a question to the desk on behalf of myself, Senator Murkowski, and Senator Romney.
Yes, that was Susan Collins of Maine. The Chief Justice reads the question.
This is a question for the counsel for the president. If President Trump had more than one motive for his alleged conduct, such as the pursuit of personal political advantage, rooting out corruption, and the promotion of national interests, how should the Senate consider more than one motive in its assessment of Article 1?
And Trump attorney Philbin responds.
If there is something that shows a possible public interest, and the president could have that possible public interest motive, that destroys their case. So once you're into mixed motive land, it's clear that their case fails. There can't possibly be an impeachable offense at all. And think about it. All elected officials, to some extent, have in mind how their conduct, how their decisions, their policy decisions will affect the next election. There's always some personal interest in the electoral outcome of policy decisions. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's part of representative democracy.
Trump attorney Pat Philbin. So why does that exchange matter? Because acquitting Trump on the basis of mixed motive land, as he called it, may make Democrats' blood boil, but it might be the talking point that a lot of swing state Republicans use to wriggle out of voting for witnesses. And honestly, those clips might be all you need to know from yesterday's 10-hour session, but maybe this one too. Democratic Senator Ed Markey of Massachusetts tees up Adam Schiff to argue that only the Senate has the power to compel John Bolton or his deputy Charles Cooperman to testify. We'll hear the question and Schiff's response.
Question from Senator Markey to the House managers. On Monday, President Trump tweeted, "The Democrat-controlled House never even asked John Bolton to testify," end quote. So that the record is accurate, did House impeachment investigators ask Mr. Bolton to testify?
Senators, the answer is yes. Of course, we asked John Bolton to testify in the House, and he refused. We asked his deputy, Dr. Kupperman, to testify, and he refused. Fortunately, we asked their deputy, Dr. Fiona Hill, to testify, and she did. We asked her deputy, Colonel Vindman, to testify, and he did. But we did seek the testimony of John Bolton, as well as Dr. Kupperman, and they refused. When we subpoenaed Dr. Kupperman, he sued us, took us to court. When we raised a subpoena with John Bolton's counsel, the same counsel for Dr. Kupperman, the answer was, Senator, you serve us with a subpoena and we will sue you too. We knew, based on the McGahn litigation, it would take months, if not years, to force John Bolton to come and testify.
Adam Schiff arguing that the only path to knowing what John Bolton knows and to having enough evidence to reach an honest verdict runs through you, dear Republican senators. With me now, Ezra Klein, co-founder of Vox, who hosts his own weekly impeachment podcast called Impeachment Explained, and has a new book called Why We're Polarized. Hi, Ezra. Thanks for coming on.
Great to be here.
Did you hear those Susan Collins and Mitt Romney questions yesterday?
I did.
More as looking for a reason to call witnesses or an excuse to acquit, even if Trump did what he's accused of.
To step back here, I want to take a moment and say that it is insane. It is constitutionally insane that we are sitting here having a conversation about whether or not four Republicans are going to break to get the testimony that has been offered by the witness who has firsthand knowledge of what it is that the president did. And the fact that this construct has been built around impeachment, that we all have to hinge on what Susan Collins says and the lift of a Mitt Romney eyebrow, this is not constitutionally how it is supposed to work. We are supposed to want to know Congress, the branch charged with overseeing the executive in this particular issue of conduct, is supposed to want to know what happened and is supposed to want to let us know what happened. So I agree with you that there was a suggestive dimension to that question of whether or not they could wriggle away by saying, sure, he might have been trying, Donald Trump might have been trying to help his own reelection, but maybe he also cares about corruption in Ukraine. Although I would love somebody to give me an example of a non-Biden or non-DNC related issue of corruption in Ukraine that Donald Trump had any rooting interest in. If somebody could say, show me the other three pieces of Ukraine-specific corruption that he was concerned about, I would be more willing to credit this answer. But nevertheless, your point is well taken that they might be looking for this as a way out. But it is a problem. It is a problem in our political system and a problem in our constitutional structure that they are looking for a way out as opposed to looking for a way to the truth.
Honestly, I was hoping this Q&A session would be more interesting than I think it's been so far. Maybe it's because I think like a journalist, not a politician. But I was hoping for more cross-examination type questions to force each side to clarify their arguments, like on what you just brought up with, oh yeah, when else have you ever talked about corruption except with Joe Biden in Ukraine, rather than teeing up your own side's talking points, which is mostly to my ear what we've been getting.
I think that one of the difficulties of the Senate trial has been Mitch McConnell from the beginning created a sense of certainty around it by saying that he was going to collaborate with the White House on this. People like Lindsey Graham saying that they were not entering into this with any doubt in their mind about what had happened. They did not believe the president had done anything wrong. And it has created a structure where there is little room for either side, it seems, to be actually looking for what happened. And instead, the Democrats are trying to increase pressure and the Republicans are trying to reduce it. When we move into an impeachment trial in the Senate is supposed to recompose itself as a trial body. It is not the Senate as we know it. It is something completely different. I mean, the constitutional law professors can go through that in chapter and verse. And that is really not what we've seen. We've seen the Senate working exactly the way it does. One of the arguments in my book and an argument we've been going through on my podcast is simply that the way impeachment was designed, it was designed based on the founders' understanding that the branches of the federal government would keep each other in check. There would be ambition checking ambition. And instead, what we see very clearly is a way that two highly polarized parties, but in this case, I think more focused to the Republican Party, have deformed that constitutional structure. So instead, what you have is parties cooperating across branches. Last thing I'll say on this is that I did think there was one very telling moment in testimony. Alan Dershowitz, the president's lawyer, made an argument that it is the case that any politician, but in this case a president, will believe that what they that their re-election is in the public interest. Therefore, if they do things in service of their election, they are doing it in their own mind, whether it is objectively true or not, in the public interest. And if they are doing it in the public interest, whether it is mediated through the role of their own election, it cannot be impeachable. And that is
the same argument basically that we heard in that Pat Philbin clip, mixed motive land.
Oh, no, I think this is a much worse argument. I think this is a very dangerous argument. This is an argument that says the president, by combining his theory of his own reelection with the theory of the public interest, nothing he can do is impeachable because by nature he is convinced it's himself, it is in the public interest. Imagine if we applied that to crime, right? Imagine if we applied that to other forms of trial. Well, I thought it was a good thing if I stole this money from somebody, so you can't be a crime because I did it with only the best intentions, which is I thought I deserved the money more, or I thought I would be able to do more good with the money than the person who initially held it. It's a very dangerous thing for a presidential lawyer to say.
I did think, and I didn't pull the clip of Dershowitz saying that because I thought watching it yesterday that it was just a Dershowitz being Dershowitz quirky kind of moment that was new yesterday. This has not been a talking point for the Republicans along the way. And it's hard for me to imagine Murkowski or Collins or whoever who may not vote for witnesses to hang their acquittal of the president based on that. Do you disagree?
I don't, but that's where I think that the overly narrow focus on Murkowski, Romney, et cetera, is actually narrowing our ability to see what is happening here, which is to say that I don't think there's any doubt that that is what President Trump believes. He has chosen Alan Dershowitz for his legal defense team. He has acted in this particular way throughout his presidency. You can go back through things like firing James Comey. There's been a clear, I think the generous interpretation of President Trump's behavior over and over again has been that he understands himself. As is true for many populist leaders around the world, he conflates himself with the public interest. And so as long as he is acting in what he sees as a public interest, if that means destroying the enemies of the people, be they Democrats, the media, whatever, that's all fine. So for a presidential lawyer to say that and say it in context or what is likely to happen here, no matter whether or not those four Republicans vote for witnesses or not, is acquittal because there's not going to be two-thirds of a supermajority in the Senate to convict the president. For the president to get away with this, and one of the arguments on which he gets away with it is that as long as he thinks it is helping his reelection and he thinks his reelection helps the country, anything goes. That's a very scary situation because he is going to be the president the day after all this anyway, and he will have all that power and he will have the freedom of knowing that even when something like this comes to light, there are no true consequences. So why not keep going with this kind of strategy in the future?
Your podcast, Impeachment Explained, focused a lot on Mitch McConnell last week, and you argue in that segment that McConnell isn't the source of our political dysfunction. He's the manifestation of it. Obviously related to your book, Why We're Polarized. Want to make that case?
Yeah. So one of the things that tends to happen in political journalism and politics generally is we personalize or we narrativize the story of American politics through individuals. And so we look at, say, Mitch McConnell and the particular way he's managing something like the impeachment trial, and we decide that, well, if only he wasn't there doing this in this way, if only he hadn't gone on Fox News and said he's going to run this in collaboration with the White House, maybe it would all be working. The reason Mitch McConnell's strategies work the way they do, the reason he chooses them in the first place and his Republican colleagues vote to uphold them, is because he is correctly, on some level, following the incentives of American politics as structured. That was true for Merrick Garland. It's true here. It's true on the Democratic side, too. Almost all politicians are incentive-based creatures. They are rationally responding to the system as it is set up. If you took McConnell out and you replaced him with a deputy, you replaced him with a John Kyle, say, we wouldn't see something different. And we know that because actually in impeachment, McConnell does not himself have the powers he normally has as Senate Majority Leader. He doesn't have the control of the floor. There is somebody else presiding over the Senate, in this case, Chief Justice John Roberts. And it is simply not the case that McConnell's colleagues are breaking en masse. There is the possibility of these three or four Republicans defecting on a witness's vote. But McConnell does what he does because that is what Republicans want him to do. If somebody else was in the chair, they would do the same thing. And you know that because all the Republicans are lockstep, more or less, behind the same strategy.
So in your study of why we're polarized, did you land anywhere close to the Republican defense talking point that Trump is being impeached because the Democrats have such partisan hatred for him rather than because he's so high crimes and misdemeanory?
I don't think that is true, but I don't think there's no kernel of truth to it, which is simply this. There is no doubt that Democrats have a lot of enmity and loathing of Donald Trump. People can argue whether or not it is justified or unjustified, but it is 100% there. The idea that Democrats dislike Trump is true. That is not why, in this case, they are impeaching him. In fact, Nancy Pelosi fought very hard to not have impeachment. After Mueller, they didn't do impeachment. When Al Green introduced articles of impeachment, they didn't do impeachment. There were arguments that you should impeach over what Donald Trump was doing on policy, what he was saying. They did not move to impeachment. And the reason is that impeachment is itself an unpopular and divisive thing to do. It didn't poll well for most of Trump's presidency. It was only when Trump more or less forced their hand by trying to intervene in a coming election, which shook Democrats' faith that they would be able to fairly beat him in an election. Because if Donald Trump is able to change the structure of the election by, say, getting Ukraine to investigate Biden, and imagine if it had worked and that story had begun coming out after Biden was the nominee, that's a way of changing the political process. So in general, Democrats very much dislike Donald Trump. But no, that's not why they went to impeachment, or they would have done it much before this whole Ukraine affair.
In fact, you wrote on Vox that you first fell down the impeachment rabbit hole in 2017. When Trump was tweeting recklessly about nuclear war with North Korea. Why did you have impeachment thoughts that early rather than just bad, dangerous president thoughts?
Yes, I have a different view on impeachment than a lot of people do, which is that my study of impeachment, I think this is correct. If you go back to what James Madison wrote about it, I mean, he says early on in the Republic that impeachment can be a usable remedy if the president fires meritorious officers without cause. So there's a lot of maladministration in early theories of impeachment. There's a lot of just what if a president is doing a very bad job. And my view of Donald Trump's presidency at that point, and it's not changed, to be honest, all that much, when he was tweeting somewhat inflammatory things at North Korea, saying that we were going to destroy them with fire, was that impeachment should be understood and not just as something that is a response to crimes or even to high crimes and misdemeanors, because that term meant something very different. It meant an abuse of power. But the impeachment is a way of firing a underperforming or a dangerously performing chief executive. And in that case, it was always understood by the founding fathers, and there's vast documentary evidence of this, as a way that you could remove somebody who was doing a very bad job. The first impeachment in American history was of Judge John Pickering, who's a federal judge. He was an appointee, and he had not committed a crime. He had not even committed what I think we would understand as a high crime and misdemeanor. He was probably suffering from early onset dementia. He was a drunkard. He was ranting on the bench. He was saying somewhat crazy things, and so he was impeached. And so my argument there, which is not really an argument about what Congress is going to do given how divisive impeachment is, but that we have become too precious about the ability to fire the person doing the most important job in the world if they underperform or dangerously perform in between quadrennial elections. The idea that the president is the only person with that kind of job security, given how dangerous it becomes if they are not performing their job well, is a strange way for us to run a republic.
Two things relevant to your book, why we're polarized. One thing we're hearing is that most swing state Republican senators who have tough re-elections this year have decided already to vote no on witnesses. We'll see if that's true, but reportedly it includes Senators Joni Ernst of Iowa, Tom Tillis of North Carolina, and Cory Gardner of Colorado, at least, deciding not to cater to the majority of their states who want witnesses. Polls suggest 70% of all Americans do, but rather that there's too much risk in alienating the Trump Republican base who they need to get reelected. How much would that calculation be an indicator of how we're polarized?
Oh, it's an extremely large indicator. So I have a chapter in the book about one of the themes of the book is the way polarization, which is the separating the parties into very ideologically and demographically distinct coalitions, has changed elections in particular. And one of the ways it's changed elections, it has sharply reduced the number of what we would think of as persuadable voters or floating voters. So you can actually go back, and there's a lot of political science literature on this, but also political consultants who talk about it and how they've run elections over time. You used to run elections by trying to appeal, both run a candidate, run a message, and run ads and ground game, appealing to this mythical but often very real voter who could move to either side, who could vote for the Democrat or Republican. As those voters have shrunk, elections become about base mobilization. And so what you want to do is make sure that you are in very good standing with your side and that the set of issues that are being discussed are issues that activate your side and depress the other side. So those swing state Republicans, what you're seeing there is 20 years ago, they'd be very worried about a voter who might defect from them to the Democrats. But now they're much more worried about having the election take place on ground that is going to be depressing to Republican turnout, which impeachment is.
And one of the things I've been hearing from political reporters covering Iowa ahead of Monday's caucuses is that impeachment isn't landing one way or another on Joe Biden. It isn't helping him because Trump's false accusations are making him more of a hero, or alienating them from him because they think even if Trump's a fascist, Biden shouldn't have gotten himself into that conflict of interest with his son. Neither is happening because the voters at events aren't even thinking about the issue the reporters in the field are telling me and my listeners on this show. So is that your sense? And if so, does it tell us anything about Washington being polarized differently from the rest of the country?
Yes, there's no doubt that Washington and political elites in general are much more polarized, but not just more polarized. They're more attentive to whatever the news cycle issue is of the moment. Whereas when you, this is an old thing, goes back to Jim Fallows, why Americans hate the media. But when you listen to the questions reporters will ask candidates, it'll be whatever happened in the news that day, what's going on in the polls, did you see the scandal, so-and-so said this, what do you think of that? And then you go to a town hall and the person says, my healthcare is too expensive, how will you help me? And so the concerns Americans have for their candidates are always different than the concerns political reporters push them towards. But I do think it is interesting that impeachment is not helping or hurting Joe Biden one way or the other. And I don't know that we really know how it would play out for him. I mean, I think something that is interesting here about witnesses is it's something that has kept the witness conversation a little bit stymied is Republicans have had this counter argument. Well, OK, what if we did it, but we did a witness trade? Now, not all of them have said they would embrace this, but at least some have floated it. And one reason Democrats have been a little reticent on that is that the witness trade the Republicans would want is for Hunter or Joe Biden. I think if Joe Biden were in a stronger position as a candidate and he were more confident in his own performance, it would in some ways be a very good thing for him to be able to come into the Senate and show that if this is truly ridiculous, then show it's ridiculous. I think it speaks not to his strength but to his weakness that there's a lot of fear about that happening.
Ezra Klein, co-founder of Vox and now the author of Why We're Polarized. Thank you so much for spending so much time with us.
Thank you.
Again, listeners, you can call and ask an impeachment news question. Just leave a voicemail anytime, including your name and where you're calling from, and some of you will hear your questions on the show. The number is 844-745-TALK. That's 844-745-TALK or 844-745-8255. Impeachment, a daily podcast, is excerpted from my live daily radio show, which we also invite you to listen to. It's The Brian Lehrer Show, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, streaming live then at WNYC.org. See you tomorrow.